Hello, I'm Juanita Williams, All Africa's Managing Editor, and we'll be discussing the Sahel region today and aiming for an understanding of the region's history of peace building and conflict, how it brought us to Niger's coup in August 2023, and what the peace building possibilities are going forward. Welcome to our three contributors today, but I'll let them introduce themselves.
Okay, so I'm Gore Amadou, a journalist from Niger Republic. I begin journalism since, let's say, 15 or around 20 years ago. So my favorite, subject on journalism is security, fighting against terrorism, or let's say, also political subject. I also am interested on social subject, or let's say, everything. As you know, in my country, we do not have, let's say, a journalist who is specialized on just one field. You know, we are most of the time journalists who can do everything. I can do politics, I can do security, I can do something. So I cannot say that I'm only specializing on one subject. So I'm, let's say, a general journalist, if I can say that.
Okay, so I'm Festus Kofi Obin. I'm a senior researcher and also a lecturer. Currently, I'm the head of research and capacity building at the West Africa Network for Peace Building, which is located in Accra, but has offices in all the ECOWAS countries. Basically, I'm in charge of research at ONEP. We've been researching over the years on issues around conflict prevention, peace building, violent extremism, gender peace and security, youth peace and security, and issues around early warning within the region. We've also been doing capacity building interventions to support state institutions, community actors in terms of their response to peace and security issues within the region. Beside that, I'm also an adjunct lecturer in a number of institutions in Ghana, including the Kofi Annan International Peacekeeping Training Center, where I used to work, and then the Ghana Armed Forces Staff and Command College, and also the Legon Center for International Affairs and Diplomacy. I think I'll end here.
Thank you very much. I'm a lecturer in the Department of Peace and Conflict Studies for Abbey College, University of Sierra Leone. And I am also a partner of Transition International, which is a consultancy firm based in the Netherlands. And I do a lot of work evaluating EU-funded projects and programs in Africa as a result-oriented monitoring expert. And I do a lot of research. Some of the work that I've done in the past, I've done alongside Festus, Dr. Obin. We published a book last year titled Youth-Led Social Movements and Peacebuilding in Africa. This year, there's a publication titled Disarmament, Demobilization and Reintegration of Ex-Combatants in Africa. And we're finalizing a book on youth and urban mobilities in COVID-19 affected Africa. So there's a lot of work done, and I also teach alongside Festus in places like the Kofi Annan International Peacekeeping Training Center in Ghana, and also do a lot of research, you know, in the Sahel and other parts of Africa. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. So in order to locate this, so what we are speaking about is Sahel region as a region, and it's recently I suppose, come into the news cycle because of the coup that happened in Niger. And then it seemed like a confluence of coups and military governments that have decided that they do not want the colonialist power that they've had before, even though they're not being colonized anymore. They've decided they don't want France in their countries at all. So Amadou, could you tell us what your analysis of the situation is, why you think the Niger coup happened, and why you think the Sahel region specifically is dealing with this confluence of coups?
We cannot say that the reason given by the junta in Niger, in Mali, and Burkina Faso. Reason given, I mean, to explain the coup were not, let's say, reason that can be, let's say, that we can consider as the truth. Because this is not true, because as you know, we just have military, let's say, head of the army who wanted just to get the power. So, I mean, the only reason that can make people, I mean, come and support the junta is to say that they are, let's say, ready. I mean, they aim to fight against colonialism, they aim to fight against, let's say, the fact that African countries who have a lot of resources, let's say all soil resources, that African countries are the most poor countries in the world, that they want to fight against this. This, the only reason is that we have, let's say, military, head of armies who just wanted to get the power. The reason given were not really, they cannot convince anyone. In reality, we have just, head of armies who just wanted to get the power and to rule the country. They just want to have means to have money to manage the country, to rule people. And if you consider the situation in the three countries we have, let's talk about Mali and Burkina Faso. We have two juntas who decided that they will set up a process that can move the country to, let's say, a democratical election. But as we go step by step, we can see that junta members do not want to give back the power to civilians. So we have a situation in which head of army said that we want to fight against terrorism, we want to fight against colonialism. So this is why we overthrew, let's say, the regime, democratical regime, who failed to gain results on these two fields. So we are here to establish a kind of new kind of governance in which Africa can profit from its resources, and Africa can decide what to do for its people. And we will be able to fight against terrorism without the help of any country. Well, the situation we have currently is that terrorism is gaining a lot of spaces in terms of territories in Burkina Faso, in Mali, and in Niger. So the situation is getting worse. So that means that the reason given were not really true, because they fail to fight really against terrorism. What we can see currently is that terrorists are stronger than before. The coming of junta on the, let's say, political field.
Thank you so much for those insights. Festus Ibrahim, historically, the Sahel region has not had a lot of peace. Could you add some perspective to what is happening now in terms of the conflict in the Sahel and how peace building can contribute to bringing a better life for people that are in the Sahel? And what the steps are that need to be taken, what steps have been taken. So I think we'll start with what steps have been taken in the Sahel that you are aware of in terms of peace building.
Thank you very much. Historically, we've had some turbulent periods within the Sahel. But I think that the situation got worse after the NATO intervention in Libya, which we are experiencing the effect of that intervention within the Sahel. Before NATO intervened in Libya, although the Sahel had some issues of governance development, the situation was not what we see today. And so since that intervention, the situation has deteriorated, starting from Mali, where we had a Tuareg rebellion, which led to a coup and counter coups. And then also bringing in the element of violent extremism and terrorism, which has spread from Mali to Burkina Faso to Niger, and also currently even moving towards the coastal states of Benin, Togo, Cote d'Ivoire. It also Since that intervention, we've seen a deteriorating of the situation, and COVID-19 added another layer to that problem, as well as issues around climate change, which also is impacting on the situation. And since then, if you recall, when the situation happened in Mali, we had a military intervention by the French called Operation Serval. After Operation Serval, we had the AFISMA, African-led mission in Mali, which was handled by the African Union and ECOWAS. That intervention helped in terms of recapturing some of the areas in Mali that was captured by the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb and Ansardine and other groups who had captured Kidal, Gao, and Timbuktu. And after the intervention of AFISMA, we saw the deployment of the UN mission in Mali called MINUSMA. MINUSMA has been in Mali since 2013 and has been helping the Malian authorities in the peace building efforts, together with other partners like the African Union and ECOWAS, which had offices in Mali. The AU office was called Miss Sahel, and ECOWAS also had an office together with other partners like the EU. The EU had a capacity building mission that was helping to build the capacity of the Malian forces. And then AU, ECOWAS were also supporting the political processes together with the UN through MINUSMA. And that is what led to the Algiers Agreement in 2015. Where all the parties in Mali signed a peace accord to undertake certain reforms to bring stability into the country. But all these interventions have not been able to stabilize the situation. And we have seen a spread to other neighboring countries and the recent coup d'etats, which has further disrupted the gains that have been made in the past. One of the challenges has been the weakening capacity of most of these states. If you look at most of the reasons cited by the coup makers for engaging in the coup, they cite as three main reasons. One, issues of poor governance. Two, issues of socioeconomic challenges, which was further exacerbated by the COVID-19 aftermath. And then three is the deteriorating security situation, where counter-terrorism effort has not worked, despite the presence of the French Operation Barkhane, the EU missions, US Special Forces, MINUSMA, and other. The situation is getting worse. That these terror groups are capturing new territories, new areas. You know, so the situation is getting worse by the day. And that is raising a lot of discontent among the population. And that is why they have, these militaries have also capitalized on the public dissatisfaction of the government to stage most of the coups that we see today. You know, so in terms of building peace in these areas, I think that the most important issue that we need to deal with now is transitioning to democratic governance, or transitioning from military regimes to a democratic order, where then the various reforms can be undertaken. Because currently, most of the military regimes lack legitimacy and credibility, even internally and externally, to even get the needed support to restore peace in these countries. So we need a transition to democratic order. And once we have a legitimate government in place, we can now look at how to deal with the issues. And this is where the AU ECOWAS comes in, to guide these countries towards that path of democratic order in these countries. But we've also seen the posture of these countries towards these three countries that are currently under military regimes, which sometimes complicates the situation. You know, but I think the first step is to transition to a constitutional order. And then from there, we could now approach other peace building interventions. And then also dealing with any colonial part that is rooted in exploitative practices. And here I'm referring to French colonial part with some of these countries, which is also one of the issues that has come up in almost all the three countries, the anti-French sentiment, you know. And dealing with this cannot be one country. It needs a unified approach. And that is where I think that the AU and ECOWAS also have to start diplomatic efforts in terms of looking at how those colonial parts can be reviewed to ensure that the engagement is a win-win situation. Otherwise, we'll continue to have a recurrence of the situation within the region.
Thank you so much for that. Ibrahim, is there anything you would like to add in terms of your understanding of what historically was done that worked? And I mean, Festus has explained now why it has all fallen apart. But I mean, historically, is there anything that in terms of peace building that can be returned to once the transitional governments are in place? We'll come back to the transitional governments and if that is, you know, that's the solution.
I will make very clear additions to what Festus has already said. But it was, I mean, even before 2010, when we had the Arab Spring and slightly after, there were clear signs that this Sahel was going to be a problematic zone for a while. It became a zone that was rooted in bad governance, corruption, nepotism, all the challenges that one would not want to see in a region like the Sahel or any other region, you know, on the African continent. We had leaders who personalized their states, leaders who believed that they could thrive only through oppressing their people. And even in countries like Mali and even a place like Senegal that has been looked at as a hallmark of democracy on the continent, we saw regular protests and we saw the emergence of social movements in those countries. Mali had Balaï Citoyen, Senegal had Yon Amar, and there were contestations in these countries between the youth and the state. Young people came to lose confidence in their leaders. There were clear messages sent, you know, and whenever they wanted to protest or challenge some of the states, the state reacted violently. So they became disconnected from those, you know, and the state failed to exist in the lives of its youth. So there was a ready-made army of young people across the region, young people who were prepared and willing to resort to any form of action that will enable them get recognition, get their voice, get their place, and the identity that states have denied them in that region. You know, there was, in the Cold War, we saw a transition to democracy, but democracy became only limited to elections, 5 years, an election, 7 years, but nothing meaningful. There was no transformative agenda in all of the countries that we look at, from Burkina Faso, Niger, Chad, Mauritania, Nigeria, Sudan, all of those. And even in a country like Nigeria, we saw the Niger Delta crisis, which the government did not learn from. And now we have Boko Haram, which affects 4 countries, Nigeria, Niger, Chad, and Cameroon. And the issues have always been the same. Marginalization of youth, ostracization, denial of socioeconomic opportunities, and all of that. So the question of violent extremist groups seizing that space was something that a lot of studies, you know, noted for quite a while. So when Libya exploded, fighters started moving down south. It was obvious that there was a lot of very vulnerable societies. And these societies did have, I mean, had no faith, no trust in their leaders, and could look for groups that could either join them in contesting against the state, you know, seeking to punish political leaders that have over time denied them access to resources and social services, you know, very basic access to education, health. Leaders were sending their children to schools in some of the best schools in the world. And people grew up not being educated, not having access to healthcare facilities. There have always been traditional methods of healing and reconciliation across the Sahel. Every country has its own approach. The question of peace building is a question that we have to look at very carefully in terms of how do we approach, develop, and use methods that will create a difference in terms of reconciling, building social cohesion, and getting these societies, you know, into a place where they could continue to function, or they could function cohesively. And Festus pointed at that. Now there's an exploitative relationship existing in these countries. We have military leaders who are pretending, a lot of them are pretending to be working in the interest of their people, trying to get elites that, you know, have wronged them for quite a while. But these guys have also been known over time to not keep to their word in terms of transitioning their countries into democracy. And some of them have no agenda in terms of transitioning their countries to democracy in the immediate future. And now you also have the question of the intentions of Russia, and which stands out there. These countries don't want to be, these leaders don't want to be pressured in terms of democracy, good governance, human rights, the rule of law. So they're looking for an alternative, which Russia provides and Wagner Group in the region provides. So we're in a very difficult, complex, and complicated place. So we have to look at this from a broad lens. First, we need to have these countries become clear, the leaders in these countries become clear as to what are the roadmaps in relation to transition in these countries to democracy. What kind of national agenda could be set that will promote healing and reconciliation in terms of enabling these countries to move forward? How can we use methods such as transitional justice in the midst of what we have? But again, because these countries also remain very unstable. For instance, if you go to a place like Burkina Faso, every day you expect a coup d'etat. Every day. In Niger, the leaders are trying to settle. So we'll begin to even speak of transition process in the next 2-3 years. So there's a lot of uncertainty. The question of material moment is not around peace building. It's about stabilizing these countries, transitioning them to a process where we can begin to look at it from a perspective of, yes, there's a threshold set. How do we build from here to have a society that is cohesive and that is functional? So maybe that is where we need to hem the conversation for now. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Amadou, is there something that you would like to add?
Yeah, I would like to add something. We should not believe that, let's say, Sahel was a peaceful, let's say, land before the rise of terrorism, or let's say the breakdown of terrorism in this part of the continent. We should remember that the destruction of Libya, we had rebellions in Mali and Niger. I'm talking about Tuareg rebellion. So we had two Tuareg rebellions in Niger. So I'm talking about before 2010. And we have also a lot of Tuareg rebellions in Mali. This part of the West Africa was a very, very troublesome situation. The situation was not really a peaceful situation. The rise of Al Qaeda and Islamic State in Sahel also helped to destroy, let's say, the situation. And the situation got worse since we had a disruption for Libya, weapons are coming from Libya to all of the Sahel. So from this moment to now, I mean, Sahel is facing, let's say, a very, very, very difficult situation. Even though we have, let's say, governance problem, we have, let's say, poverty, we have problem of education, but the destruction of Libya and also the fact that also the social component of the society were also disturbed by Tuareg rebellion. So we have a kind of dangerous situation in which a simple conflict can become, let's say, something that cannot be managed easily. Currently, what we are facing, we have to face terrorism. We have to also to face junta, who seems to not accept to go to, let's say, democracy or to organize election, let's say, democratic election. It seems that we have military, we want to stay in power. They want to stay in power. They do not really have the intention to give back the power to civilians. So we have to fight with all these things in Sahel. So that means that currently I can say that I'm very pessimistic, but there is no way to see if Sahel can be, let's say, one day, let's say, a land in which we can have peace. If you take the example of Mali, in Mali, you have two dangerous situations. You have terrorism, and we also have the uprising, also the coming back of Tuareg rebellion. I'm talking about current situation in Mali. And we have, you know, that Tuareg in Mali, there are cousins of Tuareg in Niger and also Tuareg in Burkina Faso. So we can have a situation in which all the three countries will face new rebellions, new Tuareg rebellions, added to terrorism. So you can see how the situation is currently.
Has it been your experience that the youth are caught up in what the military junta and the leaders are promising them? Because what Ibrahim is saying is, like, you know, they are promised that there's going to be progress because now there are people in power that is not the government.
I can say that, you know, when they come to when they take the power, when they overthrow democratic elected, let's say, regime, so they promise to change the situation of the country. So they promise to, let's say, to give prosperity, to give to change the way education was set up in countries. So, but if I understand what you're saying, if you see the situation really, we can see that there is no really change. So there is just military leaders who think that they can go in a way to have the people with them by saying that I will do that, because everyone live with hope. Without hope, there is nothing. So they know that, and they come with some promises and saying that they will change this, they will change that, they will do this, they will do that. But at the end, we know that nothing will change. This country faces a lot of coup. I'm talking about Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali. But the countries are still the poorest one in the world. So what can we say about that?
I mean, I do want to stay. Thank you. I do want to stay on the subject of the youth and their involvement in peace building. And, well, the involvement in what is happening in the Sahel now. A lot of the challenges that the continent faces is because there are too many leaders that do not want to give up power, whether they have been elected and those elections are called democratic, or whether they have taken power by force. It's a power grab. And the youth are the ones that are struggling to see themselves in the governments of Africa. How do you think that applies to the Sahel, specifically, Festus?
Yes. Well, I mean, when it comes to leadership on the continent, the situation in other places is not too different from the Sahel region. I think the issue is about giving the youth opportunity to also contribute to governance within the Sahel, not really about they becoming a president or leaders of this country, because I'm yet to actually see any empirical evidence of whether old people as presidents and youth as president, whether they perform better than the old people or the old people perform better than the youth. And so for me, I think that the most important issue here is giving the youth also opportunities, equal opportunities to also contribute to governance, development, and security within the Sahel. Very often, the youth have been marginalized or they've been excluded in decision-making. They've been excluded when it comes to critical issues of governance within the Sahel. And if you look at the Sahel, it's a very youthful population, if you look at the demographics. And that is why it is important to involve the youth, create opportunities for them, especially dealing with also issues that affect the youth, like issues around unemployment. You have a lot of graduates who have no jobs to do. And that is why you see a lot of them taking the very dangerous routes to Europe through Libya. You know, so the key issue for me is creating opportunities, mentoring the youth, because the youth also need some form of mentorship in order to meaningfully contribute to governance and development within the various country. I'm saying this because we've seen in other parts of West Africa where some youth have been given opportunities and they are not actually doing anything different from their old counterparts. When it comes to corruption, you find a lot of them also involved in that. You know, so it's important that they are groomed, they are mentored, they are given the capacity to meaningfully contribute to governance and development within the Sahel, and also taking away all the barriers that prevent their active involvement in governance, in politics, in development, and also in governance within the Sahel region, because the future belongs to the youth, because they constitute majority of the population, and not only even the youth, the women as well need to be given equal opportunity to contribute to the development of their respective country. So I will not pitch it around only political leadership, allowing the youth to become political leaders or president or whatever. The issue is about capacity, and we need to build the capacity, mentor the youth to be able to contribute meaningfully when they get the opportunity to serve their respective countries.
You were saying, well, we can't peace build when there's a military junta who doesn't even want to transition. So where does that leave us? How does the peace building community approach that kind of problem?
Well, I think that for the military junta, I think that the only people who can really bring a lot of pressure to bear on them is the population, the civilian population. I think it's just a matter of time. You see, when people jubilated, when the coup happened in all these three countries, it doesn't mean they think the military government will do better or they are the panacea or solution to their problem. It's just that they wanted an end of an era so that they could have something new that could help them meet the challenges that their countries are facing. And it's just a matter of time for these people to realize that indeed these military giants came not for the good of the country, but they came to also remain in power or to taste power. Because if you came to actually liberate the people or emancipate the people, then you should be willing to go through the necessary process to transition power to a civilian authority. But where you become power drunk, where you may want to entrench yourself in power, then it means that you didn't really come to really pursue the interests of the country, because the military's role is not to come and rule countries. The military is to protect the territorial integrity of states. You know, so you hand over power and you go back to the barracks. But if you entrench yourself, it's just a matter of time. And you will see a lot of public dissatisfaction and perhaps protests and demonstrations against these military regimes, which could also lead to counter coups and others within these respective countries.
Ibrahim, would you like to comment on that? Because I was speaking about what you had said about the fact that it's, you know, it's not possible to peace build in a situation like that. So where does that leave us? What is your take on that?
Peace building comes in different shapes and forms. You have peace building at the national level, and you have peace building at the subnational and then the grassroots level, different cadres. It does not mean, when I was referring to challenges, political issues and difficulties with transition, I was not indicating that peace building efforts should not go on. You know, it's not like there's a progressive approach. I mean, things that you do, they go alongside whatever challenge is there. I'm sure as we speak, there are many initiatives funded by different actors in local communities and across the countries in the Sahel. It's a massive investment in peace building. And I'm also aware of investments on young people, youth organizations, women's organization, and all of this, they all go ongoing. But you have, if you go back to the Johan Galtung triangle, the ABC triangle, that speaks to attitude, behavior, and context, it will provide an indication to you that at the end of the day, if the context does not change, we go back to business as usual. So it's a revolving door. Peace building efforts in the Sahel have been there forever. We've had military coups before, we've had wars in some of these countries, and Amadou referred to that. It's been ongoing. And this has also been a very restless part of the continent. So these efforts have been going on. But because the politics in these countries have not changed, because there is a consistent reversal to bad governance, corruption, maladministration, and all the other challenges, you know, so it becomes a revolving door. 10 years of investment in peace building will go down the drain. One day, boom, there's war or the military coup, explosive. You begin from scratch. So there has to be a deliberate, consistent, and clear approach, which is not limited only to the leadership or the people in these countries. But this is where institutions like ECOWAS, the African Union, and, you know, United Nations could provide the required political support. But again, some of these institutions have also lost their credibility. For instance, ECOWAS. You know, even when, you know, we had leaders in the region running for third term, you will have ECOWAS delegations endorsing some of these decisions, constitutional breaches in some of these countries. So they've lost their credibility, and even the opportunity and the wherewithal they had in the past to be critical, because they don't have the moral standing anymore. The AU is all functional but in name. It has proved to be not as useful as it should have been. The UN, they do bits here and there. And we saw the way MINUSMA was asked out of Mali. And we see what's happening with the French and others, even with the Americans in places like Niger. So what these leaders are also doing is to play with the emotions of people and the mindset of people. And I think Amadou mentioned this. They come in as liberators, make a lot of promises, but people just want to see change, because they also do not have trust in the political elites that are there. But we know the relationship is short-lived. It's not going to last for long. People are going to come back to their senses to say, but these ones are... And these elites are not going to go away. These are sometimes bigger or larger than the system. These are systems that have been there for years, established a state within a state. You're not going to eradicate or keep all of them away in one night. And that realization came very early in a place like Tunisia, where young people protested, fought change, believed that they had changed the system, only to realize that those that they kicked out returned in different shapes and forms. So we need to have a clear understanding as to, if we say peace building in the Sahel, what does it mean? What should it constitute? What is the nature, the structure, and the spirit of peace building within the Sahel? And the Sahel is not a homogeneous entity. These are about 9 states we're talking about, from Burkina Faso to Senegal, Sudan, all of these, you know. Sudan has its own challenges. 2 warlords, egocentric human beings, killing thousands of people within a very short period, and there's no end in sight. There's no end in sight. So it has become a lot more complex. When we look at peace building, we need to also understand how we can frame it within the context of the kind of contextual changes that we want to see that will ensure that peace building becomes sustainable. And also, what are the kind of transformative changes that will be there in relation to dealing with especially young people? One of my studies that I always refer to is a 2016 publication with a short title, We Can't Eat Peace. In French, they say, On Mange Pas la Paix. You can talk about peace building in the most fantastic of senses, but if there is no positive transformation in the lives of young people, they're not going to change. They're going to continue to want to fend for themselves and their families. They can use any nefarious means that is out there to survive. How do you, in a very realistic and pragmatic sense, also engage young people? And we're also looking at the question of gender here, where we're talking about a region where for decades women have been marginalized and infantilized. They do not have a voice, they do not have a place, they do not even have a say in some of these societies. You know, there are different levels of anger and frustration in the Sahel. And this is compounded by the unprecedented humanitarian needs. You have refugee camps across the Sahel. There's the question of the ongoing armed conflict, the question of poverty, the question of climate change, food insecurity, compounded by political instability. I think peace builders on the continent need to take a step back and engage. And when I say peace builders, I'm talking about those at the research level, practitioners that do everyday peace building, people like Festus cut across all. We talk about trainers, and then we'll also look at the regional institutions. How do we support peace building in a proper sense? What is it that ECOWAS and other institutions in the region and the AU should do that should be different, that will re-earn them their credibility, that they could be able to engage and support some of these nations? ECOWAS made a hasty conclusion on the Niger coup, threatening to get the coupists out, and they could not live up to their promise, which also dented them further, right? So there's a lot ongoing, and there's the need for us to step back, rethink, you know, re-strategize, and then see how we can engage people within these countries and support them in the most effective sense. Thank you.
I would like to add something about it. So what I want to say is, we are talking about peace building in countries which are the poorest one, let's say in Africa, let's say in the world. If you want to, let's say, set up a strategy of peace building in this country, I mean, the first thing you should do is to fight against poverty. I think this is the first step we should follow. Fight against poverty. If you fight against poverty, then you can go to the second step to set up a strategy. I'm talking about national dialogue. I'm talking about, let's say, international community involvement in managing problems of the society. So the first step, if you want, let's say, to have a real peace building in these countries, you should fight against poverty, first of all. What is democracy in countries in which people do not have enough to eat? They are suffering with poverty, unemployment, and they are also facing insecurity. So if you want to set up a strategy of peace building, I think that the first think you should do, I mean, engage strategy to set up, let's say, a project or program that can really fight against poverty in this country. We have a say in my country saying that, I mean, someone who is hungry cannot, let's say, even think about something. He's not able to think about something. So we should fight against the poverty, first of all, because we are talking about, let's say, I can repeat it, countries who are the poorest countries in the world, according to UNDP, let's say, assessment made every year. Before, let's say, engaging a kind of peace-building program in countries are saying that, we should have dialogue with religious leaders, with, women, youth and everything, we should fight against poverty. This is my opinion.
Festus, would you like to add anything to?
No, I mean, I think Professor Ibrahim and Amadu have actually mentioned all the key points. Because most of the time when we are dealing with peace building, we focus on the peace element and leave the economic dimension. You see, when people are hungry, peace is nothing to them. You know, so it is important that we highlight the economic dimension of peace building, which will go a long way to actually address the socioeconomic needs of the population, which is actually one of the main factors fueling most of the conflicts that we find within the region. So it's very important, and I fully support all the points that has been raised by my colleagues.
Thank you. We're reaching the end for you to add anything that you feel like you needed to that wasn't covered.
Yes, two very short points. One, the historical marginalization, not just of youth, but also of minority groups. Some of these countries should be looked at very closely. And also, there's historical trauma in these countries, sometimes transgenerational trauma. And if you look at the investment in mental health and psychosocial support, it's extremely limited. So, and there's a strong link between MHPSS and peace building. Comes to healing and reconciliation, it also has to do with the mindset. You cannot compound people with years, you know, of trauma, and you expect that they're just going to change overnight and embrace peace. No. And there's also the question of when do perpetrators become victims? Because society can reformat itself. So this is what we see in some of the coup d'etats, where society, you see all of these young people going after, burning the houses of politicians, supporting military regimes, you know? So you see, there is that anger that is deep-rooted, deep-seated, that trauma, you know, the perception of how people have been ill-treated over time. And even these countries are demonstrating that perception of against France, that for decades, for centuries, in fact, you did this to us. Now it's our time to fight you back in a way that you thought you never thought would ever be possible. But my final words on this, there is the need to step back, reassess peace building, to make our interventions meaningful. And this is where you need to have institutions like WANEP and also centers of excellence in the region, think tanks to sit and say, okay, what should we do? And what should we do that will be very different from what we've been using for decades that have so far not worked? Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, my last word is that to show the situation we are facing currently in my country is that there is the beginning of disappointment from the population. I mean, the situation is very, 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 very bad. You know that international economical sanctions on the country begin to have, let's say, effect on the everyday life of the people. I'm talking about the increasing of prices of essential needs. I'm talking about the lack of cash in banks. This kind of situation cannot help, let's say, the transition to go on, let's say, to go to a step in which we can have, let's say, organizing election or something. There's even, we do not have even the first step, which is the national dialogue between people, because we have one part of the population supporting the junta, and we have the other part of the population supporting the former regime, saying that they wanted the former president to be back on his, I mean, on the to be back on the on power and to continue to managing the country.
Face this.
Okay, so just to also add up, I think the role of civil society is also key. Role of the media, role of youth groups, women groups are also very key, aside the state-led interventions. And it's important that whatever intervention is being taken by international partners and by national actors, they need an active involvement of civil society, academia, the media, because when you have that whole of society approach, it leads to a more sustainable solution than few people deciding for the entire population. The other thing also is the role of ECOWAS and the African Union. I think this is the time they have to demonstrate leadership in managing our issues and not to be influenced by any external actors. They should look at the issues on ground and look at how best they can complement the effort of this state in stabilizing the situation and to achieve sustainable peace in this in these countries. The third is that we need to know that all these great powers that are within our region are here for their interests. They are not here for the interests of anybody. I'm referring to France, US, Russia, China, Turkey, and all these actors. They are just here to pursue their interests. And I think it is time that Africans become very circumspect in terms of our dealings with these actors to ensure that we have our own homegrown solutions to deal with our problems, so that these actors do not dictate how our transitions should be like. Then my last and final word is about democracy and democratic governance and how we have practiced it within the past 3 decades. The evidence on ground shows that there's a need for constitutional reforms to make sure that the people are placed at the center of governance and not the political class or the political leaders. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to say thanks so much for joining us and for sharing your expertise. I'm sure that in the future we will find opportunities to call you as we continue our peace building project at All Africa. Thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Okay.